around the same time, so I won't take time now. How many of you have listened to a talk on classical education before? How many of you took in the Grand Prairie Curriculum Fair this year? Well, there was an excellent presentation on classical education there. How many of you are using what you perceive to be a classical model of education? Okay, good. The reality with classical education is that we have a tendency to immediately equate classical with the classics. And this is true. I mean, the classics are a part of a classical education because they were really the source of information and of learning for so many years. But more important than the actual content is the learning that takes place in the classical model and the way learning takes place. So I'll just give you a brief overview. Is there anybody here who knows nothing about classical education? Okay, a few. So I'll give you a brief overview, otherwise we'd skip to the next step. The handout that I gave you gives you a pretty good outline of the basis of the trivium. But I'll just give you a brief outline of it. Trivium, this is basically in the past, before 110 years ago, everyone went to three grades in school, if you will. Grade 1, 2, and 3, and then they were done. Grade 1 occurred until they were about 5 or 6 years old. Grade 2 occurred until they were about 14, 13, 15, depending on their level of advancement. And grade 3 lasted basically for life, but generally finished when they were about 18, and then they went into a different 4 grades, basically 4 years of university, the quadrivium. The trivium begins with the grammatical stage, or the grammar stage, or the basic learning stage, the memorization stage, the point at which kids learn like sponges. And, you know, right from when they're born, they are a sponge, and they learn everything. They regurgitate amazing things. They listen to a song once, and they're singing it. They're amazing in their ability to pick up detail. And so that's a time when we have a real opportunity, a window of opportunity, to teach them memorization. You give them scripture to memorize. You give them poems to memorize. You give them mathematical tables to memorize. Now, sometimes those things don't go over very well, but if we get rid of our school mentality where now you're doing work and you have to learn this, it's amazing how much quicker kids learn them. And with my own kids, I tried to do little songs and rhythms and stuff to learn their math tables, and they said, you know, it's just not the same because that's work, that's school. It's so much easier to learn a song that's just a song. So what's wrong here? What's wrong with this picture? We're not taking the things that should be interesting. Even math tables can be interesting if you start to look at the way the numbers add up. Our youngest child, when he was 4.5 years old, I was telling a story at Christmas time. All through Advent, we spend time reading to our kids, reading classic Christmas stories. And I was reading. We were in front of the fire, and Saul was down there writing numbers on some scrap paper. 11 by 17, nice big stuff. And as I finished the story, I glanced over, and he had he was up to 190-something. And I said, wow, you got through a lot of numbers. And he looks up at me with total surprise and said, are these real numbers? I said, yes, as a matter of fact, technically they are. But yes, they are real numbers. He had discovered the pattern. He wasn't sure where he had gotten it from, but he thought he was inventing numeracy. And so he was so excited about the fact that these were actually numbers. And, you know, that pattern, there are patterns in math that are kind of fun. I mean, he was having fun. Nobody told him to do this, right? He's listening to a Christmas story, and he's writing up numbers. Well, over the next 6 to 8 months, Saul spent his time creating a math book for his friend Jesse, who wasn't doing school yet. I'm doing school because I'm doing numbers. And he created a math book with addition and subtraction. Now, he's not a whiz, but he got interested somewhere along the line, you know, the youngest of 6 children in a homeschooling family. Somewhere along the line, he picked up an interest in the numbers. And so he started doing basic addition and subtraction questions in this math book. But before he would put any question in the book, he had to be sure that there was an answer to it. I kind of smiled, but I mean, how could you possibly put a question in a book if you didn't know for sure that there was an answer? So he had to figure out all the answers first, and then he would put them into his book. And, you know, funny enough, he found an answer to every question that he created. And then once he had done all that, he had all these answers. And I said, well, you could do an answer key to go with it. So he did that as well. And he gave this as a gift to his friend Jesse for his birthday, his math text, complete with key. This is a bit of a tangent, but just to illustrate how learning really can be fun. They really want to learn to absorb and to grammatize, if you will, grammatize. They're at the grammatical stage where they want everything they can to come into their mind. So it's a window of opportunity, and we look at older kids and we go, well, they never did learn their math times table, and now they're 13. You know, we've missed an opportunity. Now they'll never learn it because they're not a sponge anymore. They're just a sponge on us. No, sorry. Just back up. But it's never too late. Never too late. I did theater for a number of years, and I worked with an actor called Gail Gordon. Some of you may remember the name. He used to come to Edmonton and do Stage West a lot. That was actually where I performed with him. And he was 87 when I did a show with him. He was still doing shows at 93, and still memorizing new scripts. And he would come to the rehearsal on day one having the entire script memorized every time, because he didn't want to, you know, trust himself to have to memorize the script during rehearsal. He wanted to focus on other things. He would always come absolutely down verbatim. So it's not too late to memorize when you're 17 if you can do it at 87. It's just a matter of you have to work harder at it. So there is a real window of opportunity at the grammatical stage, and that's where we want to just, that's where we do, might, you know, if you want to think of doing school, that might be where we do it. We give them, funnel them all the possible opportunities to memorize things. Then we get to the logic stage, and you all have probably noticed, if you have children who have become adolescent or early pre-adolescent even, suddenly they don't want to do anything anymore. They don't want to do school. And it's simply because God has created them not to. He's created them to get to a stage in their life where they don't want to memorize things anymore. They want to start to analyze the things that are happening around them. This is often called the historical stage too, and I think that's on the history. In fact, that's the main word I used. Because this is the point at which they start to see themselves relative to the world. This is where they start to notice what they look like. And it's not just a vanity thing. They're literally starting to recognize that other people have a perception of them. But they are starting to have a perception of other people. They're really opening the door on awareness of the world around them. This is the point at which they are ready, should be ready, in terms of their makeup, they are ready to learn about the world, to really study history. And not just to study history, dates, times, wars, you know, when king whatsoever lived, because that's not history, that's grammar. Right? That's memorization, that's trying to learn in the logical stage what you know, a type of learning that really happens in the grammatical stage. Excuse me. So the biggest block that we come up to, I taught junior high school, and I watched kids, and I watched, you know, many homeschool parents struggle with kids who suddenly just stop and they don't want to do school anymore. And really it is a signal that they've come to that point. Let's not force them to do school. Just the biggest thing that we need to do as educators of our own children is to recognize that the model of schooling that has occurred throughout our lifetime and really the lifetime of our parents, grandparents, many of us, is a model that is only that old. And it's a model that doesn't work. It works in grade 1 to 6. You notice how kids are zealous about school in those early years, and then something happens. And a lot of, throughout the system, it does not work after that stage. Because, this is my pet peeve, we keep teaching junior high kids and high school kids and university adults in the grammatical mode. We keep asking them to memorize stuff and regurgitate it. And we don't challenge their minds to grow the way they are designed to grow in those other stages. As a result, we have people who can memorize stuff, get it right on the test, and really haven't applied it to their life. Many of us, who came through the system are really poorly educated. And it's not that we didn't try. In preparing for this, I didn't want to kind of just take the same old approach to classical education, so I explored a little and tripped over John Gatto. And you might have noticed that Ahia did a little article in their last magazine on him. And boy, does he ever dovetail well with what I was trying to pull together. So I've got a few quotes from him. And he's adamant that the system doesn't work. And it's not that he hasn't given it a fair try. Now, he speaks very strongly against it. And I think as a result, he doesn't get the attention he should because he gives people a reactionary response. But he's got a lot of wisdom in what he says. So that logical stage, if a parent did nothing other than read and discuss with a child, they would be doing the best thing for their child in that logical stage. Then we get to the rhetorical stage, what we normally call high school, where the child, young adult now, needs to begin expressing that logic that has been developed. The student needs to learn different ways of expressing that logic that they've learned. And here's another place where we break down. John Gatto talks about, in fact, he said, I will make a challenge to any city in Canada or the United States. Give me your 20 best readers, people who can read for meaning, comprehension, your 20 best in the whole city, and I will give them an exam, an open book exam, on All's Quiet on the Western Front, simple story about World War II, and I will guarantee that every one of those students, those 20 students, will flunk that exam. Guaranteed. He said, I've been doing it in Manhattan for 10 years. He said, maybe some will get some questions right. Most of them will get no questions right. And all of them, guaranteed, will fail. Why? Because there are, I can't remember the number, about 200 ways of absorbing information from something that we read. John Gatto says there are about 12, 15, I've got notes here, but you'd rather I just talk to you, right? Approximately 15, I can give you the exact number. Do you really want it? There are 150 different kinds of information in a reading selection. Standardized tests selectively focus on, even fewer, 6 or 7 of those. So tests, the kinds of tests that we normally give kids, standardized tests, but also, challenge tests for different grades, generally focus on 6 or 7 ways of gathering information, whereas there are 150 ways. So John Gatto says, I just simply avoid those ways of asking questions. And the kids fail. And he said, the best readers are the worst failures because they are the ones who have consistently learned how to screen out the information that isn't important on a test, and to zero in on the information that is important on a test. So the ones that do the best consistently on tests do the worst on his test because they become more effective at screening out information. Well, if you're only taking in 6 or 7 parts out of 150 parts in things you read so that you can be academically successful, are you well educated? And Gatto says no. I say no. You'll say no. We all say, thank you. So the key here is not to develop thinkers who can answer questions on tests, but develop thinkers who can really think and really absorb what's coming their way and apply it to their life. So that's what the rhetorical stage is all about. What we normally view as high school should not be a time where students are regurgitating for exams and therefore failing. The more successful they are in exams, the more they are failing really learning and developing their thinking, but students who are truly expressing what they've been learning and what they're continuing to learn. So it really is a time, if nothing else, a time of expression, verbal expression and written expression. Have I kind of followed the notes here? and this is on your handout, some rhetorical exercises traditionally required of a student finishing what we would call high school. And these are good. You know, if in the high school years with your child, all they did was achieve these, this must be about a dozen, not even, maybe 10, types of expression, they'll be ready for almost anything. Number one, they must be able to retell a fable, folktale, in their own words. Relatively simple. Be surprised how many young people today cannot retell a story. Many homeschoolers can, because frankly, whether you're aware of it or not, you've given your children more of a classical education just by them living with you than you realize. You know, don't go, oh my, you know, I've missed the boat. Because chances are, if you've been with your children, you haven't missed the boat. If you've been discussing with them, I learned about classical education as my eldest daughter came through and started doing classical things with me. She taught me an awful lot about learning. And then I started doing some research and discovered this thing had existed for centuries. And my daughter had to teach it to me, and she created it herself. But what was happening was she was responding to information in a natural way. We hadn't ever forced her down any road. And so she was forcing us to be logical with her, to take her through that logical stage and to chew and, you know, hash through all the various ideas that her material was presenting. So even though we were giving her traditional school material, she was processing it in a different way. And we weren't forcing her to do all the exams and keep notes and all that kind of stuff. So, it was a blessing. But it truly was a blessing. It had nothing to do with our wisdom. The next thing is tell a fictional or non-fictional narrative. And the key in telling a fictional or non-fictional narrative is that you have to have all those elements. Who, what, where, when, why. You know, all the details to make the narrative complete. You know, we can tell stories, but can we tell them with all the wealth that a story... Really, every student should be able to write a novel. Should be able to tell a story. Recite or write an anecdote. So a story, an anecdote is not just another narrative, but a story that amplifies some particular aspect of a person or an event. And by amplifying, I mean, you know, expands on that and shows how that event is universal in its value. Amplify and argue in favor of a proverb using examples from life. So we take a proverb from scripture or a secular proverb and amplify it, indicating how it is true. And here are the manifestations of its truth in our experience in life. Speak a refuting of a position, i.e. somebody's opinion. So take somebody's opinion, something in the press, and refute it. This is where debate comes in really beautifully, you know, to be able to use, develop the student's desire to argue and use it to their own advantage, and maybe yours too. Speak a refuting of a position. Did I just say that? Speak a confirmation of a position. So also debate deals with this kind of a skill. Commonplace. This commonplace, it's kind of neat that something that was commonplace in those days, everybody would be able to do this, we don't necessarily think of today, which is the amplification of a moral quality of a certain virtue or a vice. So the moral quality, what is the positive or the negative moral quality of this particular virtue or vice? Amplify it. You know, this is an essay. Or it's a speech. Praise regarding a virtue of a person or thing. So you take Jean Chrétien and you do a praise essay. Or some other political figure. An invective, which is a censure or a criticism of a person or thing, and you could use any particular figure you wanted to use for that. I had them in my mind, I just didn't know which one I wanted to use them for. Comparisons of persons, places, and things. Personification, which is really poetry, using metaphor to illustrate the characterization of a person. A description, so an intense and graphic depiction of a subject. It's not just a general description, but this is intense description. Argument, presenting and supporting a thesis. This is like what you do when you do a master's thesis at university. And actually, to be honest, 200 years ago, students would be writing a thesis by the end of tutored or even home education, would be writing a thesis comparable to some of the theses that we see at university. I've got a friend who teaches English at a university. He said fourth year English students today are about at the point where first year students coming out of high school were 10 years, just 10 years ago. So, I mean, we're seeing a decline in literacy at an unforeseen rate. Argument, again, we're looking at, that's the one I just told you. Legislation, argument for or against the merit of law. Sounds fairly thorough, but you notice it's all expression. This is all rhetoric. But consider, given these skills, do you think maybe that student would be prepared to be involved in law, involved in government, involved in business, involved in family life, to be a person who's got influence in his community? Probably. Because not only has the individual learned how to express thoughts, but he has developed his thinking as a result of his expression. We talked a little bit about that yesterday. When we create a venue for expression, we have to think within the parameters of that venue. So if I'm expressing a criticism, I have to be able to present the opposition's defense before I can present the criticism of that position. So it forces me to think from both sides of an issue. That's different from doing a narrative where I'm just telling a story or an amplification of a virtue. So each one of those causes our mind to think in different ways. So it might seem like a simple list of different kinds of things you have to write or speak, but what it really does is expands the mind to be able to think in a wide variety of ways. So the person is truly prepared for further education. Now we're prepared to do subjects. You know, I look at things that we've done with our children, we force them to do math and chemistry, and I think we're wrong. You know, if they've got a real desire beyond the basics of math, if they've got a real desire, okay. But really, if doing math is getting in the way of the time needed to do this sort of work, and this is just part of it, right? I'm just talking here about the writing. But how do we support that ability to write in all those ways? You can't just have a tutor say, okay, well, this is the structure of writing that way. Now write it. It's not going to happen. We need ample, excellent literature so that the mind of the student is filled with, you know, beautiful ways, effective ways, powerful ways, wise ways of saying things, plus the content itself is